Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. I'm now here with Dr. Ricardo Duchesne. Welcome, Ricardo, to Millennial. People have asked me to have you on for quite a few years, so I'm glad to that we were able to arrange this. Welcome.
Yes, I'm glad to be talking to you finally, because I know you and I heard some of your interviews, so this is good.
Okay, great. Thank you for saying that. Would you like to introduce yourself to the audience just so that they know your background and what you've done and where they can find you?
Yes. I used to be a professor at a Canadian university. As some of you may know, I experienced an academic mobbing about over three years ago. So I'm no longer a professor. My research that I was doing as a professor was mainly about Western civilization, what makes it so different from other civilizations. I have a website which has been going on since 2014. And it is called Council of European Canadians, and I'm the author of three books and many articles. And currently, I'm still continuing my research on trying to determine what made the West different, which I think is the most important world historical question, and also a question that should be of interest to white people as they are facing ethnocide, for them to think about their heritage, their history, which is being threatened and undermined across the West. And so I think it is really important to talk about that heritage and for us, in our own way, to try and preserve it.
Oh, absolutely. Would you like to go into the what you just described as the academic mobbing that you endured 3 years ago? Was that to do with your research?
Yes. I mean, I wrote a book called Canada in Decade, something mass immigration and the ethnocide of Euro-Canadians. It was published in 2017. And to my surprise, to some degree, it actually right away became a bestseller and it still sells very well at Amazon. So I gained quite a bit of notoriety in Canada because of that book and the arguments that I made there. And so I think that play a big role in Canadian academics becoming aware of my views, because in that book, I, as you can tell by the title, I really argue that the current policy of mass immigration and diversity is leading to the ethnocide of the Euro-Canadian heritage in Canada. So about 3.5 years ago, I experienced an academic mobbing, basically over 100 professors and more gang up against me. And I had no choice really, but to walk away from my job. And that's really what happened. I don't want to get into too many details about that. I kind of have forgotten about it. I, in many ways, you know, I knew the danger that I was getting into. So in a way, I wasn't completely surprised when it happened. I understood the risk and I took those risks because I was hoping that other Canadian professionals would follow me, that if I took the lead in making these arguments, that I could persuade some other conservatives to join me, professionals and so on. But that didn't happen at all. You do have some mainstream conservatives, and the situation now is so bad that even they are facing suppression, and some of them have been fired. That really, in many ways, was the reason that I took a political stand that is simply not allowed in Canada, not just in universities, but particularly in universities. You're not really allowed to engage in open debate. One of the things that I have done in my research is that I pay attention to the arguments that I am fighting against. I present their views as best as I can. I present them as strong as they are, and then I try to find flaws and ways to counter them. But that's not even allowed. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that my research has always been heavily documented, cited in a very, I should say, you know, typically academic way of dealing with your opponents. You take them for what they say, what their arguments are, in a serious way, and you present your views in a serious way. But that really is not allowed if you cross that line, as you know, the line in which you question the biggest transformation that the West is undergoing right now. And there is no other transformation like this. I have studied Western history from the beginning of time, right back to the Indo-Europeans, to the present. And there have been major, I mean, the West is a civilization characterized by continuous transformations, revolutions, reformations, and renaissance. So I don't want to say that what we're experiencing now, this big transformation, has no precedence in the sense that there were no other transformations in the past. There have been others, but this one is different, as we all know, because we are talking about a replacement combined with a rejection of that heritage of Western peoples and the particular histories and traditions of the British, the French, the Germans, and so on. So that's something that really preoccupied me. I came from a leftist background. I was a Marxist throughout my student days, right through the PhD. Although I was always a person that would think, I didn't just accept whatever it is that I was told. I was very ambivalent when I was a PhD student about multiculturalism. I always felt there was something undignified about a people trashing their own history and celebrating the histories of peoples that have never been in Canada before. But nevertheless, I did remain a leftist through the first years of my teaching at a university. But then gradually I realized, and it started with my realization that the left was against the high culture of the West. That was something that I found disquieting, because for me, a university, and this is a standard definition, is a place of high learning. That means you should concentrate on the best that human beings have achieved, their literature, their philosophy, their history, what they have said in psychology and in various disciplines. Of course, it is also a place where you get a career, but there is that obligation that goes back for a few centuries, that a university is a place where we gather together to think about the great ideas of the past, the great thinkers. And when I realized that the left was not just trying to improve upon those ideas, as they claim, they say, we are progressive, we want to make things better. When I realized it wasn't really about progressing within the traditions and the views and values that were set in the past, but against them, mocking them, just pointing to the crimes that were perceived to have been committed by Western peoples, that the West really hadn't accomplished anything that was better than other civilizations. I mean, this was a standard argument that gained credence in the 1990s with the onset of multicultural world history. Western civilization used to be taught across the West. It was a mandatory course. But by the early 2000s, it was replaced by a multicultural world history. And so when I saw this trend, I began to react against it because I always had an appreciation for the achievements of the West. And I think it goes back to the fact that when I was an undergrad, I dropped out various times from university, and I went on to do my own readings and research. I would work for some hours in the day, and then I would spend afternoons and evenings reading every day about the history of mathematics, the history of science, the history of philosophy. So even though I was a leftist, I think this learning was in the back of my mind, and I took it for granted that the West had achieved all these things. So when I saw people brushing this aside, I reacted against it.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing that people could be at working at universities, Western universities, and could be entrusted with the heritage of the West, and yet these same people could think that the West is nothing. There is the thing about the analogy of the fish doesn't know what water is, because it's completely immersed in water, so it's never known anything else. I think that perhaps applies to some extent to academics. But what would you say about that?
Well, yes, I also think that for some time now, and this is something that is part of the West, and it is a big dilemma, because here we have a civilization that achieves so much, and then it starts to turn against itself. And so universities, yes, they were always preoccupied with the great ideas and the great thinkers. And people would debate what Jean-Jacques Rousseau said and what does he mean by that, and Kant. Because the reality is that if you set up a course in political theory, it's not just because you're in the West, but most political theories came from Western peoples. And so when students took courses in philosophy and political theory and so on, they inevitably read about all these Western thinkers. But because of this progressive inbuilt tendency in the West, they took this attitude that when you read Rousseau, when you read Hegel or Kant or even Plato, Machiavelli, even any thinker in the past, you're sort of looking for what it is that they're saying that points to the future, that points to a better world. Not everyone was doing this, but there was that strong tendency that we must trace a progressive line across the West that leads to where we are now and that points to a better future. And you can see this among Western thinkers themselves. I mean, a key example, of course, is Karl Marx, who says that the point is not to interpret the world, but is to change it, because the world that has been created requires a complete alteration. But they would do this with many other thinkers. They would look into Plato to see what it is that in Plato may point to some democratic thoughts, may point to communistic practices that we can learn from, may point to better relationships between men and women. So there has been that attitude within liberalism, because this is inherent to liberalism, this progressivism. And so I understood that. And I mean, when I wrote my first book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization, which I worked upon for 10 years and is thoroughly researched, I had that progressive attitude. I was defending the West as a civilization that had brought all these improvements, the abolition of slavery. So it's not just technological improvements, the scientific revolution, but things that we associate with progress. So the abolition of slavery, the allowance of trade unions, the emergence of socialist parties. And I welcome these things. And to some degree, I still do. But the academic world began to push this progressivism and then turn it against the past and start calling the past racist and start calling it all kinds of names, because with multiculturalism, they had a bigger agenda, which is that the culture of the West is not just progressive, but it also has an inherent tendency for colonialism, for enslavement, for cultural supremacy. And so they needed to really take a stronger stand against the West. And I reacted against that. And as I said, initially, my attitude was, look, come on, don't reject the West. We have good things here that we can draw from. And this is in many ways still now a standard attitude among mainstream conservatives. Mainstream conservatives believe that we can bring millions of immigrants, and you know, if only we make them appreciate the West and assimilate to Western values, everything will be all right. They're still hoping for that. They still believe in this. I eventually rejected that idea. I realized that not only because the left is adamantly against many things about the West, but that if you create a multicultural, multiracial society in which you are by necessity promoting other cultures, then there is going to be a neglect and a rejection of Western history.
Well, yes, of course, and it's because of the demographics involved, but also there is clearly a push to reject Western history and Western civilization, and even the concept that there are of Western civilization. Something that I think you might understand, this is an anecdote from my own life. When I was, we have a radio station in Britain called Classic FM. And it started at some point in the 90s, and it's just a radio station that plays nothing but classical music. And my parents never played classical music in the house. It just wasn't a thing. Neither of them was into it. But I always I was always intrigued about classical music. I wasn't sure. I didn't know anything about it, but I was intrigued by it. And then when I was about 15, I started listening to Classic FM late at night. I would fall asleep with it playing on the radio. And I still didn't know much. I mean, I knew a few composers, but I didn't know anything about music theory or the different eras of classical music. And really not much. But there was something very reassuring about Classic FM, about classical music, because it felt nourishing. It felt, even though I didn't understand it, I didn't know anything about it, I knew, I was drawn to it, and I knew this is what I should be listening to. And it wasn't even for social reasons, like I want people to think I'm clever, because nobody knew that I listened to Classic FM at night. and fell asleep listening to it. So it wasn't like I was trying to impress people or make a certain impression. It was just for myself that I felt this is nourishing. This is something important. This is something special. This is the best that we have ever produced. And, you know, that's not even to disparage contemporary music. I do like a lot of 70s, 80s and 90s music. I don't like really contemporary music, but, you know, I do have time for pop music and rock music. But there is something about classical music that it's like, okay, this is what was composed by men who were completely immersed in the project of Western civilization. And they would, each of them would see it from his own national point of view, his own regional point of view. But he was engaged in a project that spanned centuries and millennia. And these are the end results of it. These are the fruits of it. Now, I guess what I'm just saying is, can you understand that? Like a 15-year-old boy not knowing much, but feeling drawn to this thing. Because it seems to me that that instinct is one that probably emerges in people in every generation and is now being actively discouraged. And how do you, I mean, what would you say about that?
Well, yes, I mean, one of the reasons why we are undergoing such a dramatic transformation is that creating a multiracial society in which all the races feel that they belong, feel that their sense of identity and heritage is being validated. And if you look at the people who articulated the theory of multiculturalism, and Canadians play a big role in this, I explain this in detail in my book, Canada in Decay, they say that multiculturalism is necessary because human beings, by nature, are attached to their ethnic identity and their culture. You cannot expect immigrants, when they arrive here, to let go of that heritage and just assimilate to this liberal individualist culture. And the multiculturalists portray the West as a modern individualistic culture, almost as if it isn't really a culture, it's just a liberal place that grants all kinds of peoples the same rights. And so what the multiculturalists are saying is that granting this the immigrants the same individual rights is not enough. That we should also recognize their group identity. So the state should afford them, give them the means to cherish their heritage through TV channels, through all kinds of funding, through holidays for them, celebrations of their culture. And so they feel welcome. So that theory of multiculturalism recognizes that about human beings, but it doesn't recognize that about European peoples. It doesn't recognize that they too have an heritage to which they're attached and that it matters to them. Because the theory of multiculturalism is correct in that respect. It is correct that we're not just isolated beings who are satisfied with our rights as singular individuals recognized. We are also members of a community. We really gain an identity through that community. We are constantly interacting with it. We are born into it. And so it recognizes that, and I think that's a valid argument. The point is that that also has to be extended to the majority culture. But they refuse to do that because they view the majority culture as the culture that has discriminated other people, as the culture that mistreated the native Indians, mistreated the blacks in the United States. So it is the culture that has to open itself up to these other peoples, that has to recognize them and validate them. And so that's how whites now are educated to think. They're not educated to validate their own history. And my view is also that implicitly, there is a sense that we can't have schools in which we talk about the classical musical heritage of Europeans because, well, that's just Europeans. And if we do, we'll do a little bit of it, but then we'll do a little bit of many other peoples. In the end, you really don't learn anything because if people, it's not just about learning about this and that, a little bit about every other culture, but it's about feeling what is their own, what's theirs, what's their ancestors' culture, and having a sense of attachment to that. And they recognize that about non-whites, but they refuse it to recognize about whites. And it's an incredible act of violence in the sense that not only are you taking it away from the people who founded Canada and all the other Western nations, but you are not talking about this great heritage in music, in philosophy, in every field, because one of the things that I did in Uniqueness is to try and demonstrate that the West was a civilization that was far more creative than any other civilization. In fact, it was more creative than all the other cultures combined. It is something that I have done more research about since I published my book, Uniqueness, in 2011. I have kept doing research, and I'm still amazed to this day about the immense creativity that we witness in Europe, in all fields. One of the things I've been doing
Absolutely, and we can get to that, and I hope we do. But one thing I wanted to ask you before we get to that is the matter of multiculturalism, because I agree with you that minorities are... I'm sorry to cut you off there. I just want to...
that's fine.
...address this thing first. Minorities are encouraged to care about their ancestral culture. But white people, and this is whether they're in Sweden, Britain, Canada, anywhere, white people are not encouraged. In fact, they're very much discouraged from caring about their ancestral culture and the idea of Western civilization. So I guess the question is, if minorities are expected to care about their own culture, adhere to that, continue their own culture, what are white people expected to adhere to? What is the... Because you can't... I mean, I know that people say, well, white people don't have any culture, which is an insane thing to say. But leaving that aside, because we'll get to that matter, the very idea that white people don't have culture is just outrageous. But let's leave that aside. Realistically, white people do expect each other to adhere to some culture. And I guess it's an interesting question to ask, what is that culture that we are expected to adhere to? What is the culture that we are supposed to embody? Because you can't say it's a German in the sense of that someone would recognize 100 years ago, or an Englishman as someone would recognize even 50 years ago. And to some extent, it's not even a European, because that's racist to say that, well, I'm a European. You can't say that anymore either. So what's going on there? What is the identity that and the culture and the heritage?
In Canada, it's very explicit that what we are expected to adhere to is multiculturalism. In other words, Canada is a place that welcomes other peoples to cherish their culture. That's what your culture is. I understood this back when I was a PhD student. I used to think about that there is something wrong here, that you're being asked or you're being told. They use the phrase, multiculturalism is the DNA of Canadians, and it means that we welcome other cultures and we like it when they celebrate it, We want them to be in parades. We want them to be proud. And they're so bright, vibrant, and authentic. I mean, Pierre Trudeau, the father of Justin Trudeau, he more or less said that. He said that, you know, we have a modern culture here in Canada, lots of technology. We have these liberal rights and so on. But if we want to be vibrant and enriching, we need to bring all these other peoples with their real cultures. And there is that sense among many white peoples, they have been made to feel that other people are colorful. Other people really do have traditions. And in a sense, it is true, because the Western world, and this is one of the dilemmas that we need to deal with, the Western world has been eradicating its traditions in a progressive line. It is caught up in this progressive line whereby you're continuously trying to improve upon and thereby reject what was there in the past, or see what was in the past as leading to where we are now and pointing to a better future. So that's how they are raised. They're never told, hold on here. You have the Christian church, for example, the Christian heritage. You have all these different foods. You have all this music. You have these statues and architecture that surround you. They don't say that. And that is something that's around you and that you can appreciate and talk about. That's not how they do it. They neutralize all of that. So white people are a neutral people. We are a white space whereby other people start writing their cultures and making us more vibrant. So that's the mentality that has been inculcated among Canadians. And this is true across the Western world right now, because one of the biggest lies that has been inflicted on everyone is that in Canada is that we are told that Canada is uniquely multicultural. And then the idea was that the United States is a melting pot, and then they don't talk too much about Australia or New Zealand. But now we are being told really that multiculturalism exists across the board. It exists in Britain, it exists in Germany, it exists in Sweden. But the prime minister here, the journalists and the politicians will never say that. They still play up this idea that we're uniquely multicultural, even though the whole Western world has been forced to become multicultural, including the United States, because you don't have to have an official policy of multiculturalism to become multicultural. The fact that you have millions of people continuously arriving from other cultures, and then the nation to which you're arriving, be it Britain, Germany, or Sweden, doesn't take pride in its own culture, it means you're going to generate multiculturalism. So this is where, in many ways, the West is. The Swedish people, the German people, they really are not allowed to celebrate their heritage. So one of the things why I'm so keen and adamant, and I keep sometimes in Twitter and Gab, I talk about how it is that whites were the greatest biologists. They're the ones who generated all the major theories in science, the great books in history. They are the people that only that became historically conscious, and that's something that I'm writing about right now, which is that no other people in the world has the kind of highly sophisticated historiography, history writing that you find in the West. And in part it's because they did not become historically conscious. To become historically conscious, you have to have a culture that is developing and is changing, and so you become aware of time. But if you remain a state of very little change and very heavy traditions, you don't have a sense of time. History tends to be cyclical in your mind. So in any case, the point is that we in the West, and this is one of the great tragedies of diversity, we are actually pushing aside the greatest achievements of humanity in so many fields. And in universities, you're not really allowed to talk about those achievements, because when you do, it is evident that they come from the West. So I have noticed, for example, that in older textbooks, in physics, chemistry, psychology, there would always be the first few pages would tell the students who were the first psychologists, who were the first biologists, but now they're pushing that to the side. In fact, I don't remember the full details, but not long ago I came across this news in which somebody said, how come, I can't remember if it was psychology or what other discipline, but said, how come all the names here that are brought up are white men? So they don't want to portray that in textbooks. So they're taking out that early chapter that talk about the first philosophers, the first psychologists, the first biologists, the first physicists. They don't want that because they are all white males and not women. They're white males. And they don't want it, people to know, to see those pictures with the names, that this is the guy that came up with this idea. So they are really pushing this out. And in the end, this I noticed when I was a PhD student, that they have come up with this idea that all the peoples of the world are interconnected. They belong in this global village, and we have been interacting and learning from each other, and we all created modern science, we created renaissances everywhere. So right now, very serious historians, and I have written about this, have argued that modern science, for example, was not unique to the West, but it was a world phenomenon, that the Enlightenment was not unique to the West, but you find precedents or developments happening at the same time everywhere, including Haiti. I mean, there was a German historian talking about these Enlightenment thinkers in Haiti and all of that, and how all these people were part of it. So they need to get that kind of interpretation to get these students, these diverse classrooms, to feel, you know, we're all in this together. We have all participated in philosophy, in all these kinds of ideas. And it's a lie. It's an outright lie. I mean, as an academic, where your obligation is the pursuit of truth and the use of evidence and so on, I react against that.
Oh, absolutely. And I can fully understand why. The truth is a difficult thing, in the same way that honesty is a difficult thing. People think, oh, it must come naturally. But actually, honesty doesn't come naturally to anyone, I don't think, because you have to learn how to be honest. You have to learn how not to delude yourself. And
yes,
and that is tough, especially as a young man, your ego, insecurity, all this, the way you see yourself, the way you want to see yourself. So there are all these competing forces that you have to learn to discipline and push aside so that you can keep focusing on what really actually, unfortunately, is the truth. And so I think that this, I would guess, the discipline to do that used to be inculcated in people in academia, because otherwise the whole thing would fall apart. You'd have to train young thinkers, young minds, in how to be honest, how to be rigorous, how not to delude yourself, and not to give in to wishful thinking, and how not to be ideological.
I think one of the reasons why postmodernism took off in the West is that the left realized that they couldn't rely on the prior claims of Marxists, that they had the evidence, the facts on their side. When Marxists realized that there were many things happening that were going against their own predictions, against their own claims. For example, Karl Marx said that there's going to be an intensification of class struggle because capitalists are going to accumulate all the wealth, and we're going to have a situation in which you have a small elite with all the wealth and a mass of impoverished people that are propertyless. But when it was obvious that this middle class had grown substantially across the West, and that working peoples had gained higher salaries and better working conditions, they felt uncomfortable with those truths. They also felt uncomfortable with the fact that it was not the more advanced nations that transitioned into communism, but it was the least advanced nations like China and Russia and Cuba. So postmodernism then comes in and starts talking about how it is that truth is completely relative, that you can think reality in multiple ways. Now, I am aware that there is no such thing as a reality that you can hit upon directly. It does lend itself to various interpretations and contesting ideas. But nevertheless, there is always this regulating principle in the Western world that you should abide by appropriate collection of sources, at least in my case, because I did most of my studies in history, and there was always that obligation that you cannot just claim anything about the past. It has to be based on appropriate collection of sources, and you have to refer to what other historians said in the past, and then work yourself through that and try and make a claim after you struggle through all these ideas and after you put forth your sources and your facts and so on. So there is that principle, which I still think is a valid one. Otherwise, there is complete chaos. But in the case of the left, on the one hand, they became incredibly dogmatic about their moral principles, disallowing any debate and believing in them in an absolutist way. But at the same time, they argue that what had been said in the past could be rejected as untruthful, and that we have many alternative viewpoints. You can get the viewpoints of the natives and what they say about nature and what the Chinese may have said about, the natural world and so on and so forth. So that all these viewpoints that you're expected to integrate and consider. And that really is something that I disagree with. But this is a very difficult question. I don't think we can get into that right now, the whole issue of relativism and truth and so on.
Yes.
But nevertheless, it is interesting that going back to the ancient Greeks, there has been this preoccupation that is unique to Western peoples to achieve truthfulness. You see it in Aristotle's logic. You see it in his argument that there are such things as valid arguments that are logically coherent, and then there are arguments that are not valid because they're not logically coherent, or they violate the laws of logic, the law of contradiction, or the excluded middle, and so on. So there has been that pursuit of truthfulness, which really created a lot of ideas in the West, and it's behind science. It's behind the whole history of science. It's also behind proper historical writing and many other things, buildings and so on.
Yeah, I think that this idea, I mean, you didn't use this phrase, but what the expression that I've heard a lot is Eurocentric. So we're not supposed to see things from a Eurocentric perspective. And yet, the irony is that, as you say, Westerners, Europeans, white men, are actually the people who have tried the hardest to not be biased, who have tried the hardest to reach objectivity and pure logic and rationality and to see reality as it is. So we are the last people who should be pilloried for being biased, which is quite absurd, absolutely absurd. Of course, there is also the question of, is it even possible to really to have a? I feel like it's an act of cruelty to say to someone, you cannot have your own perspective. You cannot see. You must see the world from a fully universalist perspective, because that basically is. It feels like a sort of psychological abuse, actually. It's denying the person their own identity and the validity of their own unique viewpoint, because as much as we do cherish objectivity and as much as we do seek for universal principles and so on, ultimately we are still animals. We are still thinking, spiritual beings. We are still in need of that right to have our own perspective. I mean, we're not computers, basically, is the point I'm making here.
Yes, I mean, it was Europeans who invented anthropology, which is a discipline that, not in the beginning, but eventually, it's a discipline that said to researchers that when you go and investigate people in the Amazon or the Philippines that are primitive or any other culture, you don't go there with your presuppositions and biases and try and judge them and measure them in your own terms. But rather, you should try as best as you can to let go of those presuppositions coming from your culture and seeing the world in their own terms. And I think this is a good thing, because in reality, that's how you become a good anthropologist. At the same time,
a good investigator goes into a situation with an open mind.
Right. And so this is something that is unique to the West. And it seems like a dilemma, because on the one hand, the West is accused of being narrow-minded and in its scientific approach, trying to impose it everywhere. But that's not true. It depends how you approach this issue. So if you approach it from an anthropological point of view, it is not true. They did exactly the opposite, to the point that many anthropologists eventually, like Margaret Mead, began to sympathize with the other side, began to see in natives in Canada right now, natives are like, I mean, it's like there is no possible criticism you can make of them. They were ecologically minded. They have really excellent ideas about health. They were harmonious and nonviolent and so on. And this has been taught in every primary school. The students here learn more about natives than they learn about their own ancestors. That's where we are right now. So that's where eventually anthropology landed. So you can see this idea being misused in many ways to then advance other cultures as being more authentic and you should follow them and so on. But there is no need to do that just because you're an anthropologist.
If you're not allowed your own perspective, then that deprives you of the ability to judge other things in any way, really. So therefore, your only option is to approve of other cultures.
Yes. Western peoples, if they had a strong sense of identity, a strong sense of who they are, they could go and follow this anthropological approach without giving in to the cultures of other peoples. You don't have to give in to them. You're not expecting the people that you're studying to give up their culture. You're studying them and that's it. You are just presenting how they live their lives, what their religious norms are, and so on. But in the West, it became that. It became this idea that there is something better about these other cultures and that there is something wrong about the West. So the very culture, the Western world, that is so open-minded, it then turns against itself, saying that it is not open-minded, that it is rejecting other cultures. So it's a kind of paradoxical situation that the West
You could liken it to an investigator who begins to investigate himself, having suspected that he's not as impartial as he should be. He starts to investigate himself and finds out that he's a human being, and therefore, oh my God, he isn't impartial. And it just ends up with this sort of cascade effect of self-analysis.
Yes, I mean, you see this continuously in the Western world in many thinkers. I don't think we have to, certainly not right now in a short interview, but I don't think we have to make a decision as to whether this is the view we take or that view we take, because in the Western world, there are multiple viewpoints, multiple philosophies. This notion that the West is just scientifically minded and that defines it, which is very common, by the way, in the academic world. This idea that the other cultures are not as scientific minded, at least not long ago, and that we were. The truth is that we have thinkers that have explored the rational side of human beings, the darker side, the mythical side, and that who argue that for all the science, for all the rationality that you see in the West, human beings cannot overcome that archetypal past. It continues to exist within ourselves. It comes in our dreams. You know, Carl Jung said all of this. So this is part of the Western heritage. And it is an extremely rich heritage where you really have, in many ways, almost all the ideas, concepts that have been generated in history, whereas when you look at a civilization like China, and China, in many ways, is the one civilization that you could say stands at a competitive level with the West, and yet it is way lower, in my view. In China, you have these basic worldviews that emerge in ancient times: Confucianism, Taoism. Later on, you have Buddhism. Then you have the realistic school, and you have also the Mohist. And throughout the centuries thereafter, after ancient times, that's all you get. You get recombinations of these worldviews and renewals of those worldviews, and that's it. Whereas in the West, it's one successive philosophical worldview after another, so that we have so many philosophical viewpoints. Just talking about philosophy, you have materialism, idealism, existentialism, phenomenology. You name it, they're all there inside the Western heritage. And so right now, what I'm saying is we don't need to make the claim that one of these viewpoints is the correct one. It is a very complicated phenomenon. I mean, to understand reality, the world is incredibly complicated because we didn't create this universe. We don't know how this transpired, and we have no idea why we are here. So it's incredibly complicated to decide which viewpoint is the correct one. Nevertheless, the heritage is there, and this is a heritage that should be taught to students so that they appreciate it, because you're not going to get it out of African civilization. I was just reading a book on the history of philosophy not long ago. It's a recent book. And I noticed that this guy decided to add a chapter on African philosophy. And you can see him struggling, trying to determine what exactly did Africa contribute to philosophy. And he really doesn't know. So in the end, he knows he has to say that they did contribute something, because otherwise he's going to get in trouble. So he located this concept. I don't remember the exact African words, but it amounts to this. He says, we are all one and we should be nice to each other and take care of each other, something like that. Take care of other people. And so, you know, the Prince Harry and his wife, you know that, what is his wife there, of Prince Harry? Merkel? Is that Markle?
Yes, Meghan Markle.
Yes, so she actually cited that African philosophical concept after I read about it. It was funny. She was citing it and kind of saying, yeah, this is so profound, because she has a show called Archetypes. So the idea is that we need to go back to this African concept to regain our deepest thoughts. And it really just amounts, the way it is being interpreted now really is that you need to take care of Africans. You need to, when the Africans come to Europe, you just have to take care of them, and then you're being philosophical. It really amounts to that. It's an incredibly stupid, simple concept. So this is what we are being told. It's an infantilization of knowledge, and they are doing this with natives because, you know, native peoples and African peoples, you see, I also have a stage theory of history, which is that the human mind has developed and has gained sophistication, even though, again, to repeat a point I made before, was there in the beginning, the what Jung calls the archetypes, they continue, and we must be serious about that and not presume that we can be this rational, scientific people, clean of all these irrationalities and impulses. That's not going to happen. But nevertheless, you can look at the whole history of knowledge in the way some thinkers like Auguste Comte and Condorcet and many others spoke about it, which is that there are stages in, and Piaget is key to this. Piaget did all kinds of experimental studies with children, the evolution of children, showing that the mind of children's develops in sophistication through time. And then other researchers went on to show that the way that we used to be in primitive times is kind of analogous to the way children are. So I sort of believe in that when your mind is at a lower level of development in history, it does resemble the mind of a child, and that gradually in time we human beings progress to become more mature and more capable of thinking in a formal, logical, analytical way, which is important. So these are things that need to be understood. Otherwise, we are now infantilizing generation after generation with very simple thoughts.
Oh, indeed. Well, there was one thing I wanted to pick up on. You said that there's a widespread belief in academia that Western thinking, the Western mind, is scientific. But yet they also deny that Western thinking has been objective. That seems like a contradiction.
Yes, well, the argument is that science is not objective, that it is value.
I didn't think of that. Right. Okay.
Yes, which is true, but you have to be careful in how you articulate that. Again, one of those complicated discussions that I don't know if we should get into, but just to briefly give an answer. There is a sense in which science develops a methodology that other peoples have accepted this. Chinese, even the Muslims. The Muslims use the scientific methodology of the Western world to be able to carry on with their modern societies. They couldn't do it otherwise. So there is that sense in which that scientific methodology is universal and is accepted across the world, even though it came from the West. But that doesn't mean that science is objective in the sense that it captures the truthfulness of everything that's around us, and that it captures the truthfulness of how we should be ourselves. Because when I look at a scientist, and if the scientist tells me that, oh, I am the only one that's expressing knowledge, whereas the poets are not, and the people who wrote myths in the past are not, I would disagree with that. I would say that you are viewing the world in a certain way, nature in a certain way, and it is very, the results, if you master nature, are very, they augment your power, and you create all kinds of technologies, and you can see the results. But that doesn't mean that that in itself is the truthfulness of the world. It doesn't mean that that world that you're creating is the world that best benefits human beings, or that it is the world that human beings would be the happiest in. So there is more to a human being and to life than just the way science sees it.
All right. And then one other thing, just to recap what you were saying earlier, is that multiculturalism is touted as the culture of white people today. So, and I've heard this in Canada, that this is a sort of a given, this is an axiomatic truth of modern Canada, that it has no culture, there is no Canadian culture, the culture of Canada is multiculturalism. I've also heard it said of Sweden as well. Apparently, I remember a young Swedish guy contacted me on Skype many years ago, about 5 years ago, and he was telling me that that is what he was being taught in school, then at that time, that Swedish culture is multiculturalism. So therefore, there is no actual Swedish. Swedish culture is a framework in which other cultures can thrive.
Yeah,
it can operate, which immediately seems an absurd idea, because it means that there was no culture in Sweden until a few decades ago. But that clearly cannot be true. And it's the same of Canada. Sweden, you could go back thousands of years there, but with Canada, you could go back centuries. There was culture there prior to the age of multiculturalism, prior to diversity. So it's such an obvious lie. It's the kind of thing that only, to coin a phrase, it's the kind of thing that only really intelligent people could convince themselves is true.
Well, it's a very terrible thing, way to raise children. I mean, the other day, this was like when this term started, there's a primary school near where I live, and in the parking lot they set up these posters, but they put them on panels across the parking lot, like in these wooden panels, and it was all native sayings and native images and so on, about 15 of them. And I think, there may be one native or two in that school. So we have all, because I still live in an area that is very white. So these children are being deprived of their heritage, are being deprived of an identity. I often think, because I'm no longer working in a university, that I would like to apply and teach some courses in a primary school or high school, But I know they wouldn't let me because if they Google, you know, white supremacists and all this stuff. But anyways, I think about it. It would be great to just go there and just give them the basics about how New Brunswick was created, who are their people, what did they do, how hard they struggle, because it was so immensely hard for people here with the coal, without electricity, without water, to make a living. But the notion has been implanted on them, which is really one of the most egregious things you can think of, that their ancestors stole what they had from the natives. Even though they stole nothing from them, they worked everything they had. They had to build it up with their own hands. They die very early. If you go to a cemetery here, even up until not long ago, you can see that people didn't live long. They die very early. Many children die very young. So this is the kind of things that I would emphasize. Look at those cemeteries. Look at who are these people, what they built, what they created in New Brunswick, and just attach yourself to that. They would automatically attach themselves to that because that's their heritage and their ancestors, and then they can talk to their parents about who their ancestors are and create a climate of learning in the house and so on. But that's not what they're doing. They're doing exactly the opposite. Take their heritage away, shame them, make them feel bad, and then talk about the natives. I was walking in a public library inside, and I saw this big woman talking to some children, and she was just reading to them about natives' costumes. And she was just going, oh, they created these vast baskets, and they weave, and it was so beautiful. And I mean, this goes on and on. So yes, it is one of the things that people need to understand about immigration and diversity, which is a destruction of the history of the peoples of the West, outright. I mean, you know, and you see it now in movies. In England, they put blacks everywhere. This is part of it. But when you go right into the schools, that's where you see it. When you go into the primary schools and you see the posters, the images they have in the classrooms, because if it was up to me, and I would tell this to my students when I was teaching, I would say, you know, if it was up to me, this whole classroom would have posters and images of your heritage, your history about Canada, so that you can identify to that and link yourself to it, rather than all this garbage about what it is that you may have done that was not nice and so. It angers me, and that's why I put everything on the line, because I don't like how it is that what they're committing is an act of ethnocide. I don't use the word genocide because, for the sake of argument, so let's say that they're not being outright killed physically, but their culture is being taken away from them. It is being destroyed in front of their eyes, and it is happening right in those primary schools and in high schools. In the high schools here, you know, there's another high school nearby. What you get is this rainbow flag, you walk in, and this is the kind of climate you can tell already. And that's why many students, particularly boys, are not interested in learning, because they need to feel that they're fighting for something, that they have a team, that they don't want to know that my team is some other people that I never met, are these natives, and that's my team. It makes no sense. How can that be your team? Your team has to be you, your family, and your neighbors, and your people. And then you can encourage them to learn, to read history. And it would work. It's not hard, by just giving them the images of New Brunswickers. I mean, when I arrived here, I would look at the images of these poor kids. You know, their parents were the lumberjacks, fishermen. And I know they would like that history. You can teach it to them properly, but it is a travesty what's going on.
Oh, it absolutely is. I think we're at the point now where young white people, young, like teenagers, everywhere in Britain, in the old world and the new world, everywhere, probably don't actually understand that they do have a heritage. They probably are under the impression that there really isn't anything to the Western civilization. If they've even heard that phrase, they probably think it was something that we stole from Africa or something.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely absurd. But I mean, I think there genuinely is total ignorance, and it's created, I mean, it's artificially created ignorance about what our forefathers did, the cultural, philosophical, artistic strands that we come from, all of that, and of course genetic. I think the young white person today is bereft of is without history, and that's an absolutely outrageous and evil situation.
Yes, it's evil.
Yeah. It is. It is. It's completely outrageous. So to get to the thing that we were going to talk about, what is the heritage that, like, say a 15-year-old white kid today asks you something like, well, what is there for me to be proud of? What is there for me to identify with? What is there for me to know about? What is there for me to continue? What is there for me to protect? What do I come from? What would you answer? I mean, would you give them what would be in the list of things that white people, white men, have created?
Well, if we're dealing with school children, you have to reach them at their level, and I think it would be what I was saying before. It has to be a basic history of the place that they're living in. So here where I am, it would be the history of New Brunswick. That has to be up front, because that's what they can relate to immediately and make sense of. If you go or start with ancient Greece, it's not going to work. That would come
of
later.
Of course. Yes. And I take that point, but I'm wary of taking up too much of your time. So I'm trying to get you to that point where you can give the overview of Western civilization that you wanted to give. Because let's say it's not a 15-year-old. Let's say it's a 25-year-old who is full of the university rubbish, that there is no such thing as Western culture, European culture. What would you say to them?
Yes, in that case, because we live in a globalized world that's highly interconnected, and we are interacting with other peoples and civilizations, you have to give them a sense that in this big landscape, you belong in the Western world. And then you teach them Western civilization. And you can start with the ancient Greeks, or you can go before to the Indo-Europeans. But beyond the question of what it is that you would teach students, because if I were teaching undergrad university students, I would still give them a survey of Western civilization. But if you were to ask about that, as an adult, what you're thinking about the West, I would emphasize what it is that I'm doing, which is that the West is a very exceptional civilization, and that you go to ancient Greece and you realize that the birth of mathematics, of deductive reasoning, geometry, many of the literary forms like tragedy, lyric poetry, and other forms of literature, including the writing of history, starts in ancient Greece. And then you see many other things too. Of course, citizenship politics. One of the things that's new about the Greeks is that when people coalesce in the city-states, in Athens, in Thebes, in Sparta, and so on, they realize that to get a sense of feeling that you belong in this city, you have to let go of your clans, of your tribal identities, and so we're going to grant you a civic identity. At that time, civic meant something different from what it has come to mean now, because then ethnicity was taken for granted. The Greeks had a sense of Greekness, particularly after they started fighting with the Persians. They kind of became more self-aware of how they're different from other peoples in Asia. But the idea of civic identity means that regardless of what tribe you belong to, regardless of whether you're a member of this very powerful aristocratic clan, what matters now is you're a member of this city. And that as a member of this city, if you're a male and you're a free male, then you have the same rights to participate in politics. So that sense of civic politics originated in Greece, along with democratic participation. And then that that's taken on by the Romans, who develop it even further and come up with a whole concept of a republican government. You have various peoples coming together as the Romans conquer all these different ethnic groups in Italy. They integrate them into their growing society in the Italian peninsula, and they are given a republican identity. You're all equal as members of this republic. You can participate politically in it. So you can go through history that way, and you can see that the Romans created a very unique legal system that recognized the rights of private individuals to engage in contracts and their equality under the law, as long as they're free individuals in that society. And then you have the literature, I mean, the philosophy, of course, of ancient Greece. You cannot talk about Aztec or Maya philosophy. It's just impossible, or anywhere else in the world. So, you know, I used to tell my students, you have to realize that there were no philosophers anywhere in the world outside the West, other than in China. We can talk about a few in India, but they were quasi-mythical. And then a few Muslims during the Middle Ages. And really, that's about it. So this notion, oh, everybody's a philosopher, they're all roaming all over the world, it's just not true. Almost all the great philosophers came out of the West. So that question alone is very important. Why is that? And we need to know about that history. And so on it goes, the history of mathematics. I wrote about that. Ancient Greece alone in mathematics achieved more than China, India, Persia, Mesopotamia, and all those civilizations. Even though China came afterwards and the Islamic world came afterwards, when modern mathematics began with Descartes and other philosophers, they drew their ideas primarily from ancient Greece, because ancient Greece laid out the concepts for modern mathematics, not the Chinese and not the Muslims and not the Indians. And you can go on like that. I mean, right now I'm writing a paper on the history of histories, the history of historical writing. And most of it comes out of the West. Almost practically all the greatest historians come from Europe. The disciplines too. I mean, the discipline of archaeology, of botany, of psychology, of economics, of sociology, of anthropology, you name it. I mean, it's just insane. They all came from Europe. So if all those disciplines came from Europe, that tells you a lot, because that means the knowledge is all coming out of Europe. And so it is a big dilemma, because this same civilization that produced all those things is now negating itself and undermining that tradition. And it's something to think about. Why is that? Can we find the roots of that negation in that history itself? But that's another topic. But in any case, one of the things that I'm doing is that I've been writing articles about the history of cartography. For example, Europeans were the ones who mapped the whole world because they had, from the very beginning, ancient Greece, they had this sense that there was this world out there. Human beings, when they're born, I mean, in Africa, in the Amerindian civilizations, they were localized in their own world. They didn't know what was out there. To map the world and to know that the world is a globe that is round, it didn't happen. Even China had a flat earth conception right until modern times when they learned otherwise from the Europeans. And the Greeks already had this, they already knew the earth was round. So when you map the world, you're not just mapping a world, you're expressing a kind of global, worldly conception of things that goes beyond your locality, because human beings are swallowed up by the surroundings. It's just the way life is. If you go back, I mean, it's like a child is swallowed up by the world that surrounds him. He can't distinguish himself from that world. A baby, of course, doesn't even know that he is separate from the mother. He's almost so tied in and connected. So human beings are very much overwhelmed by their surroundings and unable to make a difference between themselves and their minds and the world. So the Greeks discovered the mind. That's another thing. The Chinese did not discover the mind. They you would think the mind was the heart. And so the Greeks realized there is a faculty, the mind. That's where thinking comes from. That's where knowledge comes from. And that mind perhaps should be the adjudicator of what constitutes truth. It thinks and should establish truth for itself rather than relying on truths that are roaming around coming from everywhere. So that's another thing that's what's happening there, which is very important, because this leads to the origins of self-awareness. European peoples became conscious of their consciousness, whereas other people did not become conscious of their consciousness. And to become conscious of your consciousness, that leads directly to Descartes. It's a long process, a very complicated process. But, you know, Descartes says, I think, therefore I am. I mean, he just puts it out in a formula. And what he's saying there is that my mind that thinks is that which will establish what it is that I will consider to be truthful, because I will rely on it and nothing else. Now, this can have all kinds of problems as well, because in the end, Europeans also realize there is no such thing as an isolated mind thinking for itself alone. It always thinks within a community and is embedded to a community. But realizing that after you became conscious of your consciousness, it's very different from being embedded in primitive times where you're unconsciously embedded. So the Chinese always remain unconsciously embedded. Whereas when you see Europeans later on talking about how our society, our community shapes our consciousness, they're doing so in light of the fact that their minds have a long experience of transcending the surroundings and becoming a separate subject. Again, a very complicated discussion, but you can go on like that. With you were talking before about classical music. It all comes from Europe. You know, the Greeks were already writing treatises on all kinds of different aspects about pitch, scale, harmony. Nothing like that is found anywhere else. I wrote about this. I compared it to China. Children's literature, it originated in the West. It was incredible. Children's literature was really worth reading up until recently. Europeans wrote great children's books. And you find that in...
Well, what about adults' books, though? Is it not true? Well, I mean, adults are grown-ups. Is it not true that the novel is very much a Western thing? What would you say about that?
Oh, yes, the novel. I've written a bit about that and intend to write a full article about it, which is that it was invented by whites. Novels, Ian Watts, he makes the argument that Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe, and then the name escapes me, there are Henry Fielding, and there are, it originated in Britain, but very soon you see it in France and other European nations. Now, it gets into a big debate because there are people that argue that you see novels before you see it in Don Quixote there. So there are precedents and anticipations. And then there are other people that say you see it everywhere, all over the world, because everybody told stories. But I don't believe that because a novel, I don't want to get into Ian Watts, it's kind of a bit long, the argument, but I would just say that it is reflective of the fact, the rise of, if you read literature, but I've always loved literature and I would spend summers reading literature. If you read it, one of the things that strikes you, and people who write literature are incredibly intelligent in the past because they have this ability to portray all kinds of different characters in many situations, many different personalities. You see it in Shakespeare. In Shakespeare, the personalities are no longer fixed because they were more stereotypical before him. But even though that British guy from the Middle Ages, what's his name? Chaucer?
Oh, yeah. Chaucer, yeah.
Yeah, you see many different characters there, which is unique because he already portrays them. But in Shakespeare, you see varieties within the same character. There are different conflicting emotions and character traits within the same person. And that in itself is reflective of the fact that the personality of Europeans is more advanced, it's more developed, it's more sophisticated. I know that now it's being standardized and it's a mess, right? Like when you see all these liberals, you know, going crazy and so on. The Antifa, and that is hard to think that that's a very flourishing personality. But in this novel, you see an expression of that incredible, rich, multifaceted personalities in the Western world emerging. You can notice this. This may not sound nice, but when you meet, like, for example, an East Asian, it's more stereotyped. You can see five types and you see them all. Whereas in the West, you see it in the dissident right. I mean, we don't agree and we fight all the time with each other because there's a lot of different personalities and they're pushing in different directions. So you see this in novels. It's very important. People haven't really studied this because it's nobody thinks about that, but it's an incredibly important thing. So is it really true that you see this flourishing and expression of the full personality in all kinds of directions? And you can criticize that. And I know that because we sense that there is a need for tradition now, we react against it. So we don't want to see all of that because the individual then thinks he is the source of truth and that he should express himself in multiple ways and do whatever he wants to do. So that can lead to complete chaos, to very trivial expressions of personality that now you're seeing in the West. But anyways, the point is that the history of the novel is very important in that respect as an expression of a more developed form of personality in the Western world.
And also a set of concerns that I think are pretty much unique to the West. The sense of the concern about the human condition, what it is, and the concern to be honest about life and to reflect on life as it is. I think these are, and it sounds dreadful to say that, but I think that's something quite specific to the West.
Yes.
There's a bit in 1984. I'm sorry to drop a 1984 quotes, but I'm going to do it. When O'Brien says to Winston, as you know, no novel is individually produced in this totalitarian society. And that's a sort of hot, it's a very casual sentence. As you know, no novel is individually produced.
Oh, yes.
But it's horrifying. It's a horrifying statement. Because it really means, the implication of that is what we think of as Western civilization has completely failed. That there's a profound, it's a fundamental refutation of Western civilization if we don't have the novel anymore. If the novel is now something that's produced by committee, by a group of people. I mean, this is how a lot of TV dramas are written nowadays, by committee. And we see the results. There is no honesty anymore.
Yes, you see it in pop music. I mean, pop music was good. And like, for example, rock and roll is uniquely Western and it's very expressive. You express what's inside you as an individual. And what's inside each of us is very unique. And so you want to give it out to the world and do it in a creative way. But that has been incredibly standardized by all these companies. So we have to be aware of that, that there is a counter trend for happening now in the West, whereby people are being increasingly standardized. But nevertheless, that still remains there inside the psyche of white people. I see it even in lefties when I see how they behave and their quirks and mannerisms and facial expressions. You can see the higher expressiveness there, but it's being standardized and one has to be aware of that.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely standardized. This comes back to the topic of the individual perspective. You know, if everything is produced by committee, then there is no individual perspective anymore. And that somehow means that there is no honesty anymore. Because, and I don't really know why this is, but it seems that a committee, an individual, paradoxically, an individual person is capable of giving an honest account of something or an account that rings true. Whereas a committee isn't. And I don't know if this is always the case, and I don't know why it's the case, but it seems to be usually the case. I mean, in the case of music, songs, that a song is speaking of someone's emotional experience, usually. Well, a committee can't have an emotional experience. That's not really true. So, and of course, it gets even more ramified if we're talking about novels, storytelling. It just seems to be something that's unavoidable. And as I say, this is why it's horrifying in 1984 when O'Brien says that, because it means, as I said, Western civilization is really, truly gone if we don't have individual authors anymore.
Yes, I mean, Orwell was incredibly insightful. And, you know, I just read 1984 not long ago, about 2 years ago, and I was really impressed. I had read other books by him, but I kept postponing that one, and I read it, and I couldn't believe how many things he anticipated. Another thing is that, in a way, this is what the Romantic movement in the West was about. It was about authenticity. They were sensing that the industrial revolution and this emphasis on science would kill that authentic way of being a human being and honestly expressing who you are and what your feelings are. And so you see this, you know, I mean, you see it in Goethe, the sorrows of young Werther and other romantic novels. So yes, it's that has been a very strong impulse in the West, that you can see it today, that you cannot be a stereotype. You have to be your own person and express it. At the same time, as we know, that has been carried to a point where it becomes absurd and extreme, because the less traditions there are, the less background education you have, then that's warped and distorted, and that's what has happened. Because I do think that we need some degree of traditions, and that's the dilemma with the West.
Absolutely. I mean, the person's the career of a creative person or a thoughtful person is the story of his interaction, his unique interaction with his traditions. So you obviously need both. There needs to be, it's a relationship with two entities there, the tradition and the individual person. One should not negate the other. And I think this is, again, something that's unique to Western civilization, this notion that the individual matters as well as the traditions that he is perpetuating.
Yes, like the Renaissance painters understood that you had to have a very serious technical training in painting, knowing what the masters of the past had done, go through a very rigorous training before you can actually express at a high level your own vision of the world. And you can see it in the Renaissance painters that they're contesting with each other, Da Vinci, Michelangelo, Raphael, and there were so many others. We always mention those names, but there are many others that right now, you know, the names escape me. But I wrote about this recently, the history of Western painting, which is also an incredibly creative history that has no parallels anywhere else. And in the Renaissance, you can see this increasing individualism, but at the same time, a recognition of that you're a trained painter based on the techniques of the past and the way people used to paint in the past. But nevertheless, after the Renaissance, you get many other currents of painting, like Mannerism, Rococo, and then later on you get Impressionism. I would say with Impressionism, and maybe a bit later, it's where it peaks, the creativity, and then it goes into decline in the 20th century. And in part it's because of that, because this subjectivism that's inherent to Western peoples just got out of control.
Yes.
And then it became a matter of spitting on the past, of just rejecting it and kind of pushing it to the side and pretending that you can just be absolutely on your own and remake the whole world in your own way. So then you get these abstract paintings that don't amount to much. So, it's something that happened to the West in the 20th century. But before that, you have an incredible lineage of artistic creativity. In the Middle Ages, you know, people conformed to patterns and expectations from their society. There was a way to do it, but they nevertheless did paint great paintings. And then it kind of takes off in the Renaissance.
Absolutely incredible. I get the feeling that you and I could talk all night about this stuff. It's fascinating, and we're getting into the realms of talking about creativity and being an artist and all of that. And this is really my kind of thing. It's really up my street. But I am aware that we can't talk all night, so we unfortunately we'll have to postpone that for another time, perhaps. But this has been a fascinating discussion, Dr. Ricardo. So I thank you for it. But there are some questions. So I'll ask those. I'll put those to you now. Okay, Irish Nationalist Media says, we need more professors who are as brave as Ricardo. Thank you. And then Black Pigeon Pilled says, I hope Duchesne enjoys the Tricazan Mouret books. Alexander Jacob has asked me to forward to you. Thanks for staying up for these woes. Please ask Ricardo if he intends to obtain an academic post in the future.
Me, there's no way I would be hired anywhere. I mean, I cannot even get a job in a primary school.
Right.
There's no way. I mean, I cannot get a job anywhere.
Right. That is just evil. And I'm really sorry. As somebody else said in the live chat earlier, the fact that this man has been kicked out of academia in Canada tells me a lot about it. It tells me everything I need to know about Canada. For what it's worth, people do sympathize with your situation. Okay, Darby said, this has been such a splendid millennial so far. Been watching since 2020. Thanks for promoting Canadian voices within the dissident right woes. Yeah, there are a lot of Canadians on this year, and that actually wasn't a deliberate decision. It's just the way it's happened, and they've been very interesting. So, it's turned out well so far. Question for Ricardo. Have you ever travelled out to Western Canada? They seem to have a much different mindset than the average Canadian.
Oh, yes. I've been to Vancouver a few times. I was invited to speak at the University of British Columbia two times by a student group there. The second time, it was like there was a riot and the Antifa arrived and so on, and they tried to close down the talk. But anyway, I met a bunch of guys there. They invited me to a restaurant, and we were like 20 guys, and I was really impressed with how many guys were there that think this way and that they keep in touch with each other, because where I am, I'm completely isolated. I'm looking forward to the possibility of going back there.
Excellent. Okay. Darby also asks, what is the best way to support your work?
Well, I mean, I'm in Twitter now. You can check me out there. And sometimes I do post my articles there. And I also have a website, and you can find me in that website, the Council of European Canadians. I have articles by other people. So you can support, if you do want to support it, you can support that website. I mean, we take donations, and we've been around since 2014, and we are getting young writers, and your support is actually essential to keeping the website functioning.
And that website is linked in the description under this video, so people can get to it easily. George James says the following. George Lincoln Rockwell described communism as the mutiny of quantity over quality. Others have suggested that envious malevolence is its driving force, the driving force of communism. I would like to ask Dr. Duchesne what he feels drives the development, recruitment, and practice of the various cults of equality, feminism, LGBT, multiracialism, etc., and why it never stops at equality, but always seems to proceed to crushing excellence, imposing mediocrity, and frowning down upon everything of value, and dare I say it, everything of beauty.
Yes, that's a question that requires a lot of thinking, and it's a long answer. I will only give a very brief suggestion, which is that I think, and this is really the biggest dilemma that I'm facing, which is that the very same West that produced so much great art, history, culture, and so on, did engender this equality movement that has turned against the West. And that's something that we have to think about. Is it something that is inherent to the West and we cannot get rid of it? Or is there a way for the West to follow a different path that is still anchored in its history, but it doesn't lead into this negation of itself?
All right. That is a very difficult question to approach. I agree with you. Darby also says that university is now mandating indigenous classes as a prerequisite for all degrees. It's just ridiculous. That seems to be something that's happening in Canada, but I know similar things are happening in Australia as well with the Aborigines. Okay, and Privileged Shitlord says, European intellectual curiosity has been weaponized against Europeans. What would you say to that?
Well, yes, in a way, as I was saying before, they have weaponized many ideas from the West against the West by arguing that the progressive ideas that are being expressed today, the seeds for those ideas were already there in the past, equality, diversity, and so on. That's the argument they're making. And there is truth to that. Clearly, what's going on in the West didn't come from the outside. It came from within. And of course, there are hostile elites participating in this as well. But they work within the West and utilize Western ideals to push this kind of anti-Western, anti-white stuff. So again, it goes back to something that I'm currently thinking about, which is how it is that this great civilization is now turning against itself, and what can we do to still preserve and value that heritage? And it includes individualism. Individualism is a key component of the West. How can we value that without having to accept where we are now, the road that we have taken now? And I think, to give a very short answer, it has to mean a reassertment of traditionalism.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. By the way, somebody has said, Ricardo, I'll second what Inso said. You really should create video content for Odyssey and other platforms. It's a great medium to present ideas, and video content will be seen by more people than read books. Sad to see. Than read books. That's just something you might want to consider, video content of your own, because you obviously, I get the feeling that you could talk about many different subjects, and I think it's a worthwhile idea. Alabama Hot Pockets says the following: equality is the religion of the denizens of academia, and reality is utterly blasphemous to them. Remember that to them, even God is subject to the rules of equality. It is their moral imperative to shape the world in their image. Equality is the religion of academics. What would you say about that?
Well, yes. I mean, equality is a big term. It means many things. If you say, for example, let's say you're living in a small city state and you make the case that everyone here who is a member of this city-state should have the same right, equal right, to participate in the politics of this state. Well, that doesn't sound too bad. So there is that idea of equality of rights to participate in politics, equality of rights to express your viewpoint. Again, keeping in mind that there are always traditions that set limits to what you can say. But equality, as it is understood today, is very different. It means that we're going to equalize the West with the rest of the world to the point that they're going to be equally integrated into the Western world and be equally a part of the Western world and claim that world as their own, as they claim their own world. So that's a very different concept of equality. So when we think of these terms like liberty, freedom, equality, individualism, they all have a history. So it depends when you pick up the term. So for people in the Renaissance, individualism meant something different from what it means today. Likewise, for the Greeks. So there is this history, it's a very complicated history whereby the term individualism takes on different meanings. And now it means a very abstract individual who is separated from his own heritage and culture, and it's kind of just rooted nowhere, and his lands are populated by all kinds of individuals from nowhere, and they are consumers, and they work, but they're not rooted anywhere, and all the stores look alike, and they're generic, and belong to everyone. So it's, this kind of equality is very different from how that concept was understood in the past.
Yes, certainly. Okay, some random bloke says, have you seen the arguments by mainstream conservatives such as Neil Ferguson that the West might have been the civilization that was the best, but it was all environmental, such as the Protestant work ethic, adoption of free markets, individual rights, etc.? They all ignore race.
Yes, I review his book on civilizations, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, and I did make that argument against him that he reduces the West to contemporary liberal values, not the Antifa extreme left values, but to mainstream middle of the road liberal values. And he is a person that believes that individuals from all walks of life from around the world can belong in the West as long as they assimilate to the rule of law, a free press, and equality of rights, and so on. So these are strictly modern liberal identifiers of the West, but I believe that other identifiers of the West, or what makes a person Western, including your ethnicity, your race, because, well, let's stick with ethnicity, because a German cannot be defined solely by these liberal values that Ferguson endorses. A German is also a German, and he has a particular history and is rooted in a particular place. So he doesn't consider that. And that's what I mean when I say tradition, and that this something that has to be recognized and affirmed. If this individualism that we value is going to be able to sustain itself, because it cannot sustain itself the way it is now. We are being standardized and we're being controlled, and it's actually becoming totalitarian. So you have to have, whether you're in Britain, you're a British individual, but that's where you are. You're a British individual, and this is where you are and your family is and your ancestors. You're not just British because you happen to have individual rights in Britain.
Well, indeed. Okay, I think that's all the questions. So I guess, I think that's it. Ricardo, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I've really enjoyed it. So thank you for agreeing to do it. It was I wasn't sure how it would go, but I think it's been one of the best so far this millennial. So thank you for your time.
All right. Thanks a lot. Millennial Wolves, I guess that's your name. So
Colin.
I'm glad that we had a conversation, and that I honestly don't know how you do it, that you hold on to this. It's not a marathon. It's a marathon every day. So it's amazing.
Well, thank you. It's not that difficult once you get into the cycle of it, the routine of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, by the end of it each year, I am generally exhausted. Yeah. But yeah, it's an enjoyable thing to do.
All right.
Okay. Well,
have a good Christmas.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I'll be back in 10 minutes with Semiogog. But in the meantime, Ricardo Deschain, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Okay. Bye-bye and Merry Christmas, Dr. Ricardo. Bye. Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.